So good afternoon, everybody. Welcome once again to the ARMS conference here in Berlin and to this session in particular. I'd like to thank you all for coming here. My name is Daniel Baranowski. I am working for the Federal Foundation Magnus Hirschfeld here in Berlin. That is the Bundesstiftung Magnus Hirschfeld. And I'm in charge of all things related to LGBTIQ culture, memory, and history in the foundation. And I am very delighted to chair this session, which is called Queer and Trans Elders, Memories, Collections, and Libraries. The fundamentals are outlined very quickly. We have three presentations by actually four speakers, and each presentation is scheduled for 20 minutes, after which there will be approximately 30 minutes for questions and discussions. Our first presentation this afternoon comes from Harrison Appel, who is the founding co-director of the Pittsburgh Queer History Project, which is PQHP in short, I think. And he's a PhD candidate of gender and women's studies at the University of Arizona. The research focuses are oral and public history, archival studies, and queer history. And the dissertation, A Social Member in Good Standing, theorizes how non-normative sexual communities formed under deindustrialization and globalization through the lens of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania's after-hours gay social clubs. And outside of their academic work as a community archivist, they arrange public workshops, free digitization service, screenings, art books, performances, and exhibitions, and they've brought copies of the PQHP's newsprint magazine. No, they didn't. Okay. So forget about that. You have to ask them. And the title of the presentation, which is about the Pittsburgh History Queer Project, is a quotation, and a very good one indeed. I want to come out looking glamorous one more time.
So it's much longer than I remember sending. I apologize for making you read all of that. Are we ready to go?
I didn't touch it.
It was never your fault. No, no, no. Maybe we can swap displays. That doesn't help.
I can actually remind you of the theater play in the evening, which is very good indeed. I saw last year the Einstein sect about Magnus Hirschfeld at the hall where we were in the morning by the Livingston's cabinet from Copenhagen with English subtitles. That's very good. So you know.
Here?
Paul Cohen, Merce Cunningham. Anyway, without further ado, this, I agree, it's a lovely quotation. It comes from The Woman in White on the left. But I realize that it doesn't tell you a lot about what I'm actually going to talk about today. So this presentation reflects not only an event that occurred, but a new online collection for the Pittsburgh Queer History Project Archives, documenting the One More Time Ball, a drag ball from 2013 co-created by myself and a group of Black queer elders in Pittsburgh, and how the process of putting that event together transformed my relationship to oral history and archival scholarship. Now, it's a bit of a truism to claim that oral history criticism has been struggling to articulate the interview's value as a mode of historical inquiry since its professionalization. But in that literature, it is rare to find writing on the relationship between the oral historian and the narrator as something other than either objective journalistic encounters or some sort of thrilling academic collaboration. The mainstream literature on oral history's value, I think, continually etches out its parameters, outlining the active space of and rich moments of history in the making from its excesses, and it abounds with metaphors of gold panning to review oral history writing from its heavily circulated advocacy by American oral historian Studs Terkel and his many academic disciples, all the way to its infamous takedowns by social historians like Barbara Tuchman. But my experience creating the One More Time Ball would not have been possible without its excesses. In fact, what is likely a familiar and ironic sentiment to anyone here practicing oral history is that the interview frequently gets in the way. My aim to collect historical data through interviews with my friend and narrator, Connie Dorsett, revealed tension over the unavoidably extractive nature of the interview, clashing with our relationship that had made communication possible in the first place. Given our conference's anniversary status and the clamoring by younger queers to have elders, I want to present this paper in part to propose an alternate definition of that relationship as friendship, which is also to say formless, unpredictable, erotic, and always present. After the interview failed Connie and I found that queer oral history writing, what little of it there is, was riddled with excessive pleasure and suggests that the effort to uplift the interview as the productive document and reason for relating casts a blind spot on the under-theorized methods for how we create new historical knowledge in the collision of desires. So in my work to create the Pittsburgh Queer History Project, I try to focus on opportunities to make oral history and community archiving a reciprocal practice. This requires reframing our expectations for outcomes, our definitions of evidence, documents, provenance. The ball made no promises to answer my research questions. It was about directly supporting my narrators in a variety of ways, financially, logistically, aesthetically, sexually. By exchanging my desire with Connie's, foregoing the oral history interview for the creation of the One More Time Ball, we stuck to our excessive pleasures and produced a document for new historical literature anyway. I hope this presentation can stimulate reflection on what it means to listen to someone else's voice, for how they tell you what it is they want, and how this is inextricable from the promise of making history. So let's meet Connie. Connie's here on the left in her much younger days, 1968, about. She doesn't remember when this photograph was taken, but they were in a bar with a Wurlitzer and not much else. So the One More Time Ball was a collaborative effort. With my friend and oral history interviewee, Connie Dorsett, and she had wanted to get elder performers back on stage in drag after many years of reminiscing over the phone, which she consequently hates. She had wanted to put the ball on since at least 2007, and it's the first thing she told me when we had our first meeting in 2012. We had met through a mutual friend, Laura Grantmeyer, who had been interviewing her about a community history of drag queens in Pittsburgh's Hill District, an African-American segregated neighborhood that had been torn down by the Urban Redevelopment Authority of the city to build a now-demolished sports arena and Nylas Fallow in unavoidable housing. Laura focused on stories of female impersonators who appear in the large photography archives of Teenie Harris, the Neighborhoods and Black Communities at Broad newspaper and portrait photographer for the Pittsburgh Courier. That collection is now housed very officially at the Carnegie Museum of Art in Oakland. So at that time that I met Connie, I was interested in focusing on stories about this network of after-hours clubs in Pittsburgh, owned and operated primarily by working-class white gay men and lesbians, their racial status and careers in bars that helped them access property and highly coveted liquor licenses, but hosted a mixed-race membership. And one of the most popular clubs through the 1970s, the House of Tilden, is famous with queer elders in Pittsburgh, including Connie, who recalled performing there in its lavish interiors. It used to be a speakeasy for the upper classes in Pittsburgh, but when they figured out they were going to be indicted for all of the illegal activity, they handed it over. Yes, I appreciate it, because that is my ultimate flaw. So despite searching through 12,197 photographs that I had collected from one of the owners of the House of Tilden, owner in huge quotes because you can't own a club, Connie was nowhere to be found. Instead, she could occasionally spot a few of her friends and acquaintances, almost all of them now dead or long out of contact. And Connie's conspicuous absence from the photographic record forced me to think through what kinds of forces had already narrowed a seemingly comprehensive and vivid record of this membership. Further, her absence in the photographs and stories of former employees challenged this powerful record of nightlife with the memory of someone who has a stake in its trace but cannot be found in it. And that those same forces operated on our relationship, an agreement through oral history to talk about queer desires and genders and places, and our respective sense of what constituted modern Pittsburgh had also collided along the color line that had impacted what was left to constitute a queer community archives. So I was excited for her to participate as a narrator who could put the relevance of the club in perspective through her experience of racial discrimination within a queer community and gender non-normativity. She had worked in and out of female drag for many of her years, both on and off stage. She does not use the word transgender to describe herself, though she is both Uncle and Aunt Connie to many people, including myself and my partner, with whom she shares accessories, makeup tips, and many other pearls of wisdom. As Connie and I's relationship grew, we began to discuss how the emphasis on her value as a text of the past completely disinterested her. Not that she was against revising a history of Pittsburgh's nightlife, but that the process of being excavated and analyzed also felt basically like being buried alive. Her insistence on the obvious, that she had not ceased to be valuable in her old age, might resemble the words of activist Miss Major, who says, in no uncertain words, "I'm still fucking here." Oral history was not necessarily prepared for what she had to offer or what she wanted out of history work. So I think of the times I would come over to talk and look at pictures, and Connie would be playing Candy Crush or leaving the TV news on at full volume while I asked questions about the music box or local history. And the comprehensive interview not only bored her, its emphasis on memory of a shared timeline rarely, if ever, discussed her present and her expression of historical memory. There was no reason to dig my heels in over extraction when I've been told clearly that this is not going to happen. She got her name the Queen of the Commonwealth by refusing the local gangster to give $10. And when he came back, he said, "You think you're Queen of the Commonwealth?" Yeah, he's dead, she's still alive, so she is still here. Over the next year, I spent more of my time with Connie with the tape recorder off, talking about both of our lives. Our method became less like the familiar structure of interviews that minimalized the researcher in order to develop a more clear portrait of the subject. Connie took me on as someone to teach. Our differences and her authority as gay, as a woman, as an African-American Pittsburgher who had outlived many of her friends, and as an all-around hellraiser defined our relationship. She would tell me when I do or don't look glamorous, ask me to check in on mutual friends, and arrange our trips to the occasional drag show if they could barely meet her standards. It's a power dynamic of intergenerational conversation that also made clear how my own access to resources should be helping her live in the present rather than dwell exclusively on her past. At the time, I was an artist in residence at Carnegie Mellon University, so I just lied to a lot of people and basically gave her a bunch of money. And we did that through the One More Time ball, which kind of acted like a rent ball. So when we all but abandoned the interviews as our defining framework for our relationship, Connie and I started to work on the ball. She wanted to come out looking glamorous, as she said, recounting the ball she had thrown, attended, and swept in the 1960s and 70s. And we set out on this sort of reenactment, which taught me more about Pittsburgh's history and the clash of our respective understanding of its present than any interview had, or I imagine will. After striking out with several gay bars in town as a host for her dream ball, we booked the Bulgarian Macedonian National Cultural and Education Center Social Hall in Homestead, Pennsylvania, because they had a dance floor, which was usually used for ethnic tanzen, a kitchen, which they would let us use for free, and they would let us run our own bar, non-negotiable for Miss Connie, because you can't make money without it, and they gave us a cut-rate rental fee because it was a senior citizen event. The manager later told me that I had lied, but we had already signed the contract, and that next time he would not be so easily fooled. He did give me a small vial of rose oil because, quote, "No one should leave without something from Bulgaria," end quote. Which is to say, you know, fool me once, shame on you. So Pittsburgh's first lady of drag, Kiera Darshell, was the MC and revealed that three connected generations of drag existed between herself and Connie. Her drag mother, the legendary Denise Darshell, who died from AIDS in the late 1990s, was mentored by Connie in her youth while growing up in Pittsburgh, but had never connected the two while she was alive. Guest performers like Milan Trejour gave us Retro Diatra, Hicks for Your Nerves, and JoJo Gilbert, the last remaining member of the Pearl Box Review, at age 74 in pumps and full makeup, gave a a cappella spoken word story of her life mixed with the Broadway lyrics of Gypsy Rose Lee and Eartha Kitt. It was fabulous. So I'd like to pull a quick quip from JoJo's performance to illustrate the genre of storytelling that this ball supported, that the formal interviews could not. I'm going to quickly move into YouTube. I know this sounds scary, but it's going to be fine. All right. it. See how that worked? Yes. Do we have audio? One more time? Not to quote the ball itself. I need to... Is that it?
Kid up here doing what she done. But when we came along in the day, we had a show. We had Snake John was on my show. We had Doreen Corey, Goddess of the Jungle. I say that this is a lovely place. And I love the mistress of ceremonies. The kid that was taught, I don't know her name, but I remember she talked about Denise. Denise was my daughter. I called her my daughter because I remember she's beautiful, beautiful kid. She's drag queen. She's dead and gone. I took her reward now, but I loved her. She was a sweet person. She was a very fabulous drag queen. And I'm surprised. I'm wonderful to see that kid up here doing what she done. But when we came along in the day, we had a show. We had Snake Charmers on my show. We had Doreen Corey, Goddess of the Jungle. We had Lottie the Body. Now I'll tell you, when I brought Lottie to the stage, she was a stripper. And I would bring her on the stage, as ladies and gentlemen, bring her to the stage, Lottie the Body. She's going to flip and flop it, tip and top it, bring down front, let all the boys watch it. But you know what? The life I live is a life I love. And I've come a long ways, baby. And I got to give my glory. I got to give my friend Connie Dorsett, Queen of the Commonwealth. We go back. Now, I call her. We go back over 25 or 30, 40 years from Rochester, New York. And she was young and I was young. We were both working in restaurants, but I was entertaining on the side. And we go back many years, and I'm here today because of Connie. That's why I'm here today. And I want to let you know that life is a journey. And when we go through it, we have to make the best of what we can, why we can, when we can, and how we can. I've seen a lot of things from my guests pass away, young and old. And at my age, I mean, I've seen them go, I can count them over. And on my hands, I can count over 200 or 300 that's been gone. Fabulous drag queens. I came along with the Pearl Box, with the Jewel Box Review when I was a kid, 11 years old. My mother took me to see the Jewel Box Review. And I remember Chumba. She was Spanish. And there was Dodie Daniels. And there was quite a few fabulous entertainers on the Jewel Box Review. And I remember the day when I was about 11 years old, my mother took me to see the first female person who became a woman, Christine Jorgensen. And so I go back a long ways. I've seen a lot of live shows in Buffalo, New York, Lena Horne. In fact, Bobby Lopez, the one who was in the Pearl Box Review, my manager, was a dress designer, made fabulous clothes, was a great sewer. He made clothes for Connie. And he danced in stormy weather. He was one of the dancers, and dancing back in stormy weather. And he died at 70-something years old. He had Alzheimer's. But he was fabulous. I met a lot of fabulous queens, drag queens, in my day. That's gone on to their reward.
Baby, you feel bad.
Oh, thank you, darling. But you know, so, you know what I tell them? I say it's a little fat, but they can get with that.
All right. Wow, that echo is really powerful. Okay, where is the PowerPoint now? Thank you. And we're back. Okay. Can I get a quick time check? All right. 8 minutes. Wonderful. I can do that. Now, several years later, I've had the chance to reflect on the One More Time ball and situate my thinking about the friendship between myself and Connie and the need to support that ball in relationship to oral history criticism coming out of the 1970s when feminist, new social history, and queer oral history scholars repeatedly re-theorized oral history's methods from their post-World War II form to support the creation of new historical literatures, what Ronald Greeley had called a better and more conscious history. In the late 1940s, Alan Nevins and the Columbia Center for Oral History had developed an extremely journalistic view of oral history, such that it should be replacing the kinds of memos and documents that were no longer arriving in archives due to the rise of telecommunications, air travel, thank you, please, Seth, and other things that would basically cut down on the amount of written correspondence that would fill the fonds of important figures of government agencies and the military. And he was responding to this sort of drying up, what Gerald Hirsch called an archival-based or archival-driven oral history movement. And it's particularly vulnerable to some acidic critiques from document-based historians. I mentioned Barbara Tuchman before, but I've included this quote not because I think it's evil, but I think it's really fabulous. She famously torpedoed the rapidly growing collection of memories from powerful figures, claiming that real historians are drowning in endless trivia produced, quote, by the creature oral history born of the tape recorder, a monster with the appetite of a tapeworm. We're going to make our next publication called Tapeworm, by the way. All sorts of people being invited to merely open their mouths and ramble effortlessly and endlessly, all for a few veins of gold and a vast mass of trash. And so while her critique is obviously exaggerated, even by her own admission later on in the paper, there is a vein of gold in it, to use her own words. And it's that the value of oral history cannot be taken as self-evident. Michael Frisch, whose concept of shared authority has become a sort of gold standard of late 20th and 21st century oral history education, explained this through the dichotomy of more history and no history. The former, more history, describing the instances in which oral history is collected simply in order to bolster pre-existing historical literatures with more stuff. And that the latter was the complete refusal of the history profession in favor of firsthand accounts. Oral history, he said, hangs vaguely in the middle. And a shared authority was a theory that the promise of oral history was that historians could begin to incorporate multiple ways of knowing, different kinds of intelligence into the profession, especially seeking out those which had been structurally excluded by hegemonic orders of race, class, and gender. Entering the 1970s, we see a greater change of object for oral historians, away from recuperating the facts, studying memory as a creative act. Feminist and queer scholars further argue that the meaning of oral history need to consider how these communities that they are interested in, whose historical consciousness does not steer the collecting missions of institutional archives, tell their stories. In concert with Frisch, people like Sherna Gluck, that's not here, that's Esther Newton, were writing that every oral history between two women is a feminist act because it is allowing a connection between generations that was foreclosed before to take place, to be archived, to be used in the future. Feminist oral history also introduced the language of self-reflexivity to the field, demonstrating that class, race, and gender differences between oral historians and narrators are constructive themselves of the oral history interview's content. However, the standard discussion of that relationship between oral historians and narrators was frequently idealized as an equalizing apparatus, even if only temporarily, whether it be Frisch's collaborative vision of shared authority or Gluck's feminist encounter. In short, it was an effort to make oral history a champion of subjugated knowledge. The profession had only succeeded in temporarily sharing that authority by expanding the archives available still to career historians. So in queer oral history scholarship, I would leave that change, and it was in order to build trust with narrators, queer oral historians describe engaging with the everyday reality of inventing relationships that are not already structured by normative models. So where relationship building could be admired as a courteous means to an end by some scholars before, queer oral historians have argued that it is required, if mandatory, of making communication across difference even a possibility. Esther Newton's reflective essay on this, writing about the residents of Cherry Grove, Fire Island, in that she writes of a friend and informant, Kay, an elder white lesbian and cottage owner. She says, "My key informant and sponsors have usually been more to me than an expedient way of getting information, and something more than just friends. Information has always flowed to me through a medium of emotion, ranging from the passionate, although never consummated, we say, erotic attachment through profound affection and lively interest. That is what empowers me in my projects, and when it is reciprocated, helps motivate informants to put up with my questions and intrusions." And she ends in another essay on yams, grinders, and gays, anthropology, and LGBTQ history. "If the burden of authorship cannot be evaded, neither can the burden of being seen as an erotic creature. Even on days when Kay had no new story, no information or photograph to offer, I enjoyed being with her. What's deep about her is almost all nonverbal." And I think it was her use of reciprocation that struck me the first time I read this, that it was not an excess or ethical gold star that she had been talking about, but that this was a crucial element, mandatory for making this connection possible, and it cannot be done without it. We must be really willing to realize where the tradition of oral history fails to meet the needs and desires that emerge in that relationship. And I've seen her work picked up by Horacio Roque Ramirez, who in the edited collection Queer Bodies of Evidence writes about his relationship to Alberta Navarres or Teresita La Campesina, a Latina trans ranchera singer who was famous in their community and, under the words of Horacio's dear friend, had become his method. So when she passes away, the grief that he expresses in an article called Sharing Queer Authorities is not so much about not being able to use her any longer as a resource, but to recognize that the work itself, in a way, had died, that that was something that cannot be recuperated by endless writing through publication. And the theme of friendship was picked up by Esther and Horacio, insists that oral historians know we have more work to do. And last, I want to end with a quote from an interview with Michel Foucault by René Descartes, asking him if there's an important thing about this intergenerational relationship. And they're all talking specifically about gay men. But he says, yes, a very profound one, between a man and a younger woman, and I don't love this, but here it is. The marriage institution makes it easier. She accepts it and makes it work. But two men of noticeably different ages, what code would allow them to communicate? They face each other without terms or convenient words, with nothing to assure them about the meaning of the movement that carries them toward each other. They have to invent, from A to Z, a relationship that is still formless, which is friendship. That is to say, the sum of everything through which they can give each other pleasure. And what we have to learn from experiences in queer oral history is just that. In making it our goal to share authority, our task at hand is giving pleasure, not just panning for gold. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Harrison. Our second presentation is from Taipei-based queer performer and scholar Yan-Zhen Chen. He graduated from the Department of Drama at National Taiwan University of Arts with a special focus on queer performance, and he is currently a graduate student at the Graduate Institute of Taiwan Literature at National Taiwan University. And his research interests include queer history, gender studies, literary theory and performance discourse. He's also a renowned queer activist in the gender movement in Taiwan who combines social practice, critical theory with analysis of cultural phenomena in order to construct or reconstruct a queer landscape through the lens of historiography. And his articles can be found online in Medium Yan-Zhen Chen. And the title of his presentation is Reconstructing Queer History in Taiwan, the Memorial Identity of Gay Elders Communities in Cyberspace.
Oh, hi, everybody. My name is Yan-Zhen Chen. I'm from Taiwan, not China. Okay. And my topic is Reconstructing Queer History in Taiwan, the Memorial Identity of Gay Elder Community in Cyberspace. There's a book, 以静大同 台北生活志, has recalled the first gay bar, Man Qing Fang, and the scenario of contemporary nightlife in Taipei, delineating the lifestyle of LGBTQ in Taiwan. The book made me wonder how we can reconstruct queer history in Taiwan through the lens of queer memory in cyberspace. The contemporary digitalized online social media bear collaborative disidentification reconstruction of minority community. The concept of collective memory from collective memory written by Maurice Habermas has indicated the collective memory is constituted by specific groups. In light of this, I point out the personal memory can be developed in cyberspace to extend that is represent diversity of the minority groups. And here I quote an essay on the website. It's by Jay Liao, My Memory in Funky. He said, my first experience to gay bar was in Funky when I was underage. I could not remember who brought me to Funky. All the fragment of memory I can recall was that I went there with my second boyfriend. That club goer exchanged phone number on the song requesting memo, that I had sex in the restroom there for the first time. Although those memories helped me recollect my teenage life, after several decades, the past me, Once a little boy who only meets other gay in the 228 Mario Park and Funky was not Navy anymore, and now Funky has been closed for good. In this paper, I consider online social media a medium to empower the minority groups to fight for the access of history interpretation. I discuss the way in which queer memory in the cyberspace, which I call digital queer memory, reconstitute queer history in Taiwan. This digital memory, on the one hand, reshapes the historical landscape of the queer history in Taiwan, and on the other hand, represents the hegemony of gerontophobic gay mainstream. Hobsbawm has not in a queer time and space. The queer temporality can be quite different from the normative one. That being said, gay elder might be performing something alternative to the mainstream queer temporality as they barely participate in mainstream nightclubs in Taiwan. The memory of gay elder not only resists the operation of heteronormativity, but also problematizes the hegemony of young gay. In this sense, this paper investigates the nightclub memory constructed by gay elder in cyberspace, noting how the digital queer memory reshaped the queer history in Taiwan and reconstruct the identification of community of gay elders. In Archive Fever, the HIDA emphasized the importance of trace behind the historical construction and pointing out the violence and devastation in the process of archive selecting. Queer memory has always been marginalized not only in the heterosexual history, but also in the domain history of homosexuality, and even in the hegemony of history. Online video, book, and the image, the cyberspace provides a way to store queer memory to extend imaginary community online. However, the cyberspace is never a safe ground for digital memory as it faces the risk of document disappearing when the website is collapsed. Here I quote, I would not be able to face if the website full of my team memory being shut down forever. This essay is What Happened to Tor Wang, written by an anonymous netizen LOUSD 浪云客寻对的你 on the BBS. In order to show his mourning over the loss of information that vanished along with the shutdown of Tor Wang. Tor Wang in Taiwan is a gay form. You can share your experience, your love story, or meet some new friend in this website. And this issue takes place anywhere, whether on this website Tor Wang, or on BBS, whether on the website TT1069, or on Facebook, all popular social media in Taiwan. And TT1069 is another gay form. You can share your sex video, your dirty photo on this. Yes. And the queer memory becomes the trace behind the history with a capital H, echoing the fragility of digital memory. Queer memory is a means to defeat the grand narrative of history and provide flexible micro-narrative to approach the dynamic formation of historical landscape. However, you should be known that digital queer memory mirror both young gay domains and elder gay survival. Here is the statement quote from Taiwan Tongzhi Hotline Association, points out an excessive fear about being older in homosexual community. This aging anxiety was further ignited around 1983 in Taiwan by Shen Yong's novel Crystal Boy, one of the renowned queer novels that describe gay life in Taiwan, had represented an interesting fetish for the young body in the gay community. This phenomenon of 青春崇拜, that means we like young boy body and Yes, it is a day by Jidawei, foster the hegemony of Yang and locate Yang onto an upper position in the hierarchy of gay community. The cyber state in the way also accelerate and reinforce the operation of hegemony of the discourse. In the post-capitalist area of social media, the hegemony of Yang has extended through online dating apps and the website that shape the imaginary of gay with efficient technique. Take the internet form of gay on BBS as an example. I look into the title of self-introduction essay post on this website that constructs the threat of seeing 30 years old as a new stage of gay life. It means that gay elder refer to those who are over 30 years old. Yes, and I near 30 years old, so I'm okay, yes. According to the aforementioned, the gay young not only construct the hegemony, but also deprive elder of its definition. In both reality and the virtual space, young become a hegemony in gay community. In Taiwan, gay young seem to often exclude gay elder and maintain the cultural apparatus of gay ecology. Now the local gay nightclub has catalyzed a young historical landscape of gay nightlife in Taiwan, such as G-Star, Abrazo, and the Ferry. Yet it is also possible to rethink digital queer memory developed by gay elder as chess that represent the history that have been forgotten. The digital memory of gay elder, on one hand, echo the moment when they were young, and on the other hand, question the monopoly launched by the young ideology. And in addition to constituting history, it is significant to know that memory of gay elder as marginal chess performing a vulnerability of Taiwanese gay men and the political negative of gay community. The tragic memory of Nong Anpa, shared by many gay elders, remind the public the violence of homophobia in Taiwan. Those gay people in this picture, actually they have clothes on their body, but the policeman asked them to take off their clothes in order to let the journalist to take this photo. The queer memory of gay elder in the cyberspace reconstruct the historical landscape and problematize the hegemony of gay young. The digital memory make it possible the gay ecology in the cyberspace, as Fang Ting Zhen paper Digital Diaspora and the Queer Imaginary, Lesbian Boy Rainbow Village, and the Queerology. It is a day that digital not only mobilize the development of queer community, but also work as escaping tactics. Queer memory of gay elder catalyze gay and gay disidentification and the escaping tactics within. The digital queer memory cancel the boundary of biculturalism in young and elders. As I mentioned in previous session, digital queer memory work within and against the homophobia and the heteronormativity in the past. Here, I quote some flashback of those years in Funky, writer anonymously. He said, "This was my first time to go to Funky when I was 18. I went to Taipei from Kaohsiung alone. Chinese song for people to dance cha-cha were the hits, and people must dance in a circle. Everyone tried hard to grab the microphone so that he could see in the public. However, some seemed to have the village to cut in when they request a song. I only drank beer, then I hide into the private room and zone out on the chair. I never got drunk. It was so packed. I used to arrive at there at 9 o'clock. Yes.
Okay, this nightclub memory is translated into intermittent signal, which are recalled on the internet to be read by specific generation. And further, the time and space are in disorder on the virtual space. The tracks, which I call digital queer memory, are transcribed into this application and the history when they are read. When we enter keyword and surf, the information pops up. Digital queer memory expands the operation of community identity. And digital queer memory of elder is gap between the society of compulsory heterosexuality and of domain young. And here is the news on the newspaper. He asks why the gay elder is disappear in our society in Taiwan. Yes. So in the post-capitalist era of social media, virtual community have transformed into hitting battlefield and empower minority to fight for the interpretation of history. But the queer memory in the cyberspace is a double-edged tactic because it's also ironically represent the hegemony of gerontophobic gay mainstream rapidly in the virtual space. Even though the gay youngs in the process of socialization construct hegemony by regarding gay elder as an exclude other, the memory of gay elder in cyberspace problematizes the mainstream gay ecology in Taiwan. The digital queer memory that gay elder left in the virtual proof that gay elder actually and virtually participate in the gay community and even further reshape the historical landscape of queer history in Taiwan. That is to say, those queer memories woven by local gay elders are integral conversation and interplay between different generations. Yet, it is critical for us to see the digital memory as an ambivalence, as mentioned before, and that we have to face the possibility of digital memory that vanish easily. Yes, it's my paper. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you so much, Yen. Our last presentation is from two speakers, Jennifer Evans and Benny Nemirovsky-Ramsey. Jennifer, who will be second, I think, is a professor in the Department of History at Carleton University, Ottawa, and she is also one of the co-editors of the voluminous book, Was ist Homosexualität? What is Homosexuality in German from 2013. Benny is a Montreal-born artist, diarist, and PhD researcher based in Edinburgh. Collections holding his work include the Kunsthistorisches Museum in Vienna, the Polin Museum for the History of Polish Jews in Warsaw, the Tielska Gallery in Stockholm, and the National Gallery of Canada in Ottawa. And their presentation is called A Touch Across Time, Queer Ways into Queer Libraries.
Thank you. I actually shortened the title to Queer Ways into Queer Libraries, but touching across time is definitely something that Jennifer and I are concerned with. So it's a pleasure to be here to present my work to the communities that have gathered here, and also to further advance my collaboration with Jennifer Evans, who is a historian at the University of Carleton, who is supporting my artistic research through dialogue and academic writing that is funded by Canada's Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council. Thank you. As Daniel said, I'm a Montreal-born artist and a researcher in Edinburgh, where I'm completing a practice-led PhD funded by the Cruising the 70s research project that some of you might be familiar with at the Edinburgh College of Art. Since 2000, I've produced a large body of time-based works which feature the human voice as my chief artistic material, taking form in videos, sound installations, and most recently in critical and affective audio guides for the collections of a number of museums across Europe. And actually, most of the museums that Daniel mentioned are museums where I've done something with their audio guide systems specifically. Thematically, the majority of my artistic projects seek trans-historical touch with identities, practices, and ideas from gay, lesbian, and queer history, driven by a desire to resuscitate and recirculate them into contemporary cultural discourse. And my doctoral project emerges from this impulse and involves a series of artistic gestures that dialogue with the homes and, in particular, the private libraries of a loosely interconnected group of gay scholars and community elders, notably Geert Hekma and Matthias Douwes in Amsterdam, Adrian Rifkin in London, and Thomas Waugh in Montreal. Although I've also done research visits to the libraries of Paris scholar René Scherer and the artist and writer Hervé Guibert, whose book collection has been preserved in its integrity since his 1991 AIDS-related death. I've also corresponded with a number of queer community elders with notable libraries that I have not been able to access. So, I tried. And the final artistic output will use the audio guide form to mediate encounters with the domestic spaces, private libraries, and kinship bonds of my hosts, seeking to trace connections between them, real and imagined. The process of developing the material for this audio guide involved significant amounts of time spent in my hosts' homes and being folded into their daily lives. It also resulted in a number of artistic experiments that served not only to amass data, but also to develop new aesthetics and research methodologies to suit the particularities of the spaces my work seeks to mediate. So for my presentation, I would like to briefly outline three such experiments to give you a picture of some of the queer ways I have been encountering and navigating these libraries, and after which Jen will make some comments on her relationship to the research after I'm done. So the main site of my research is the home of Amsterdam scholars Geert Hekma and Matthias Douwes, whose vast library of over 7,000 books reflects decades of passionate scholarship and collecting. Their collection spreads across some 20 bookshelves, ranging from little glass cabinets to massive wall installations that dominate their spacious, plant-filled apartment, hidden from the red light district's culture of display. The library's topics are as broad as they are specific. The Marquis de Sade and his legacy, sexual liberation movements, masturbation, male prostitution, the intersections between sex and crime. There are a few books on werewolves. There is a shelf devoted to child sexuality and intergenerational love. They have first edition copies of the earliest German sexology books, a section on urinals, about 500 biographies of figures from queer history. They have every issue of Butt magazine. My artistic research, and there's Geert reading on the balcony. My artistic research began with a test audio guide of Geert and Matthias's library that I presented as part of the cultural program of a conference honoring Geert's retirement from the University of Amsterdam. Entitled "The World Will Always Welcome Lovers," the 30-minute audio guide toured the rooms, garden, and book collection of their home, recounting the couple's activist history, there's Jen listening in, reading passages of selected texts, and encouraging the listener to have a sexual encounter with a book in the toilet. Approximately, it was good, it was hot. Approximately 70 people, most of them Geert's friends, colleagues, and former students, experienced the tour one at a time over 3 days in the summer of 2017. This event was meant to serve as a sketch for the greater audio guide project that would be the final artistic output of my doctoral research. And while most audience members expressed enthusiasm after experiencing "The World Will Always Welcome Lovers," I felt that my approach had not done justice to the histories and affective dimensions of their home that I wished to animate. The style of narration I used, which was largely transposed from my previous work with museum audio guides, did not serve the library. Its didactic voice was too determining, and the thoughts and feelings of the audience too marginalized. In short, I left this experiment feeling that the aesthetics and methods of my project were not sufficiently queer, and this attitude catalyzed the scholarly research and artistic experimentation that became the focus of my doctoral research. My reflections on the shortcomings of the Amsterdam tour led to experiments with more participatory, more embodied, and hopefully queerer approaches to guiding individuals through the homes and libraries of my hosts. The first experiment of this kind emerged as part of my research into the library of London writer Adrian Rifkin and his partner Denis Echard, and was prompted by an invitation to be guest curator of the Naked Boys Reading Literary Salon, which some of you might know in London and Berlin sometimes. Curators of the salon are tasked with selecting a program of short texts, which are distributed to a group of performers who recite the texts naked, on stage at the salon. I reimagined the role of curator by designing a navigational score that led participants through a series of sensory and affective encounters with the library in search of the text they would read at the salon. A garden party was held in Adrian and Denise's backyard for the participants selected for this edition of Naked Boys Reading, all of whom were queer-identified men. I distributed the scores in the form of a screen-printed hand-bound booklet, you already saw that, which participants were invited to follow at their own pace. In keeping with the audio guide aesthetics of my research, the score began much like a tour of an historical site, introducing the reader to Adrian and Denise's home and providing basic information about the library's contents and systems of classification. From there, the reader was instructed to tune into the library's affective dimensions and unstable temporalities, to focus on a specific bookshelf devoted to queer and sexual literature, to select a book based on the title's erotic promise, and to transcribe a short passage from within its pages. After completing their transcriptions, the men reconvened outside, where they enjoyed the sensory pleasures of the garden and casual conversations with Adrian, who had withdrawn to his study during the action. There's Adrian on the left. The score was designed to not only empower the participants to select the texts they would read at the salon themselves, but also to encourage an experience in Adrian and Denise's home that left affective traces in their minds and bodies. My hope was that the atmosphere of hospitality, the multi-sensory stimuli of the garden, and instructions that emphasized listening, touching, and eroticism would be embedded into the meaning each participant made of their selected texts, and that this meaning might influence the experience of and level of investment in reciting their texts at the literary salon. Naked Boys Reading took place 2 days later in the form of a performance installation at Lux Moving Image, and involved each participant reciting his selected text in various spots throughout the venue, which itself included a garden and a library. My research into the use of a navigational score to encourage an embodied, affect-led mode of meaning-making was advanced in a similar action that took place in the Montreal home of film scholar Tom Waugh. The action concentrated attention on Tom's vast collection of books and videotapes, while simultaneously exploring the library's relationship to the nearby Bain Colonial, a men's bathhouse where Tom hosts weekly gatherings of a community of friends, colleagues, and former students. 25 members of Montreal's queer community, and Jan, representing a diversity of ages, sexual orientations, and gender identities, were invited to a gathering at Tom's home last summer to enact a score based on reading, transcribing, and exchange. The style and content of the handwritten photocopied score was modeled after the one I used for Adrian's library, beginning with a tour of Tom's home, a description of Bain Colonial, and the role the bathhouse plays in Tom's methods of creating community and fostering pedagogical exchange. There were similar instructions about selecting a book that held some erotic promise, transcribing a passage of it, but rather than recite these passages at a later public event like Naked Boys Reading, participants were asked to seek out a fellow participant, establish their consent, and share the passage with them. The atmosphere of hospitality established in the garden party at Adrian's was augmented in Tom's home through a dramaturgy designed to evoke the sensory and affective dimensions of the bathhouse. Participants were provided with a towel and a space to change out of their street clothes into something more appropriate for a bathhouse. A fog machine released a vapor into the rooms that contain Tom's books and film collections, evoking the wafts of steam that fill a bathhouse. A soothing erotic soundtrack played throughout the house, a buffet of food and drink was provided, and participants were invited and encouraged to take showers in Tom's two bathrooms. As a final overlap between library and bathhouse, participants were asked to gather on the roof terrace of Tom's house once the action was over, from where the roof terrace of Bain Colonial is also in view. Well, let's get to it. Lots of pictures there. An impromptu reading of text passages selected from Tom's library were recited by a number of participants, an expression of the group's sense of shared authorship of the action, and there's Jen reading. And there's the whole group. And maybe Jen, if you wanted to come on up and take over. So those are the three actions that I wanted to share with you, and I'll hand it over to Jen. Should I keep this picture?
Yeah, I'll do that. And I actually noticed that I'm wearing the shark shirt in Amsterdam and in Montreal, meaning I should have worn it today, obviously, because that's apparently all I own. So thank you for that. I'm just going to pull up my text. Otherwise, I have to do it off my computer. So you'll forgive me. I should say that in addition to this being Benny's dissertation, there is also a plan to have a distillation of this as an exhibition at the Carleton University Art Gallery. And so what I'm going to speak to actually sort of has you imagine that a little bit, and I'm going to just grab my computer. So, forgive me. Perfect. It might be very obvious, you know, why an historian of sexuality would find Benny's work infinitely interesting, but I thought I'd maybe speak a little bit to what I have found enthralling in Benny's practice and how it helps me rethink how we can do the history of sexuality. So this is really Benny's baby, as it were. I'm just along for the ride occasionally. And our relationship is one of mutual conversation and interdisciplinarity. I'm an historian, but one who has often been frustrated with how we write about the lives of our subjects. I'm a German historian in particular, a historian of Europe, but also a visual culture of photography. And I'm interested in ways we can use and employ more artistic conventions for getting at a broad, diverse range of historical experiences in the past. For reasons that are completely understandable, given my field and the depth of history in a space and a place like Berlin, I found that there was an overwhelming emphasis on the histories of policing, of regulation, and of underground lives and coping strategies, while subjects like love and lust and cruising and just plain sex often fall by the wayside of academic writing and research. And maybe we could talk a little bit about that, because that's come up in all three of these presentations. Benny's art and his practice is deeply historical. At the same time, it's playful, it's experimental, and it's inventive. It is at once bound to history through the objects in these libraries and the interviews with their owners, but it's also creative and fanciful. Benny's not beholden to the truth in the same way that a historian often is, in the way that we often have to reconstruct at least various historical imaginaries to explain the actions of our subjects and why they act in the way that they do. Benny doesn't have to explain an outcome of his work. He's able to paint pictures in broad strokes and use oral and visual images that conjure ideas and spur thinking. I've accompanied him on parts of this journey as both a conversationalist and a participant observer, and I've written about his practice in other places. I thought it might be useful to offer just a few points, maybe three, to sort of galvanize some ways in which I, at least, as an historian, find his work incredibly generative and incredibly enriching. Benny's practice is a way of documenting and re-presenting a form of queer kinship beyond the bounds of filial relations, a kinship based on intellectual, on social, and often sexual bonds between the owners of these libraries, between friends and acquaintances who entered into the space at one time or another, and through the objects and writings that link us to them in a kind of queer literary or intellectual imaginary. The ties that bind communities in Benny's project resist the framework of the family and instead offer a more flexible, yet no less significant way of imagining queer worldmaking. It hinges on what Benny describes as his process of finding participants itself, that is, a form of cruising, of ambling from spot to spot, following one's instincts, reading a situation, using all of one's senses. It can be both frustrating and delightful, frustrating when it doesn't quite go as planned, and exuberant when things fall into place. The project is both his art of gathering material, but it is also how he intends to present it, using audio guides as a medium through which to lead visitors through an exhibition experience. These short sojourns that he creates through sound, voice, movement, touch, fantasy, and storytelling fly in the face of traditional audio guide formats, and their often regulated, perfunctory, fact-oriented way of casting the past to the listener. Benny's approach is more evocative. It's designed to stimulate the senses, to instill in the listener the impetus to imagine on their own what they are encountering. This relies on oral, visual, and haptic sensations combined with movement to create subjective, embodied encounters with the past made present, filtered through the experience of the audience person themselves. It's a shared encounter. In this way, it forges connections between persons and objects and orientations in Sarah Ahmed's sense. Benny creates new opportunities for empathic knowledge, but it's a knowledge that isn't universalized. His use of stories and sound is often open-ended. It's polyphonic, it's multivalent. But is it history? Historians always have to bring everything back to history, right? Is it history? Like the indigenous author Thomas King argues that fiction and storytelling provide opportunities for new forms of subjectivity that are often not represented in hegemonic spaces and places like the museum or in history writing. Benny's work, the interplay between voice, narration, music, and sound, holds a special kind of recuperative potential to revive a sense of possible ways of being historically that fall from view in most historical and museological traditions. I've also found it helpful to draw on the work of performance scholars and those studying reenactment, historical reenactment, people like Vanessa Agnew, as an example, for the way they argue that conjectural representations and reenactments, part of the affective turn more broadly, present new possibilities for critically engaging with a spectrum of possible pasts. Benny's work shows us that evocative, fanciful, creative, aesthetic approaches to the queer past sometimes are more capable of reaching across time, maybe, than some of our own forms of historical production. I look forward to questions you might have for the panel. Thank you.
Thank you, Jennifer and Benny. Would you please come up and join me here on stage? We've got 25 minutes now for questions and discussions concerning these amazing presentations. So there is a microphone in the middle of the room, and for those of you who don't feel comfortable with going to the microphone, I will hand it to you. but there is already one question.
Thanks, everyone, for those presentations. This is a question for Harrison. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit more about, you said you spoke a bit, you hinted at the kinds of ways that you're developing to support your narrators financially, and I wonder if you can, there's a lot of debate about that, obviously, and I would just love to hear more about what you did and how you did it and other thoughts you have about it.
Thank you. That's really an exciting question to answer. So if anybody here is planning to go to the U.S.-based Oral History Association in Salt Lake City in August, I believe? No, October? I should really keep better track of those dates. There is going to be a panel that I'm a part of that touches on this thing specifically, and also there will be a sort of anti-conference that was sort of formed in reaction to a very critical response to the discussion of wanting to pay your narrators because their labor should not be made to be seen as totally compensated by being suddenly made part of history, however you plan to do that. In my case, I think of archives as fundamentally, not fundamentally perhaps, but always a class issue. Who can retain materials, hold on to them, be a part of their ongoing preservation depends on so many everyday factors, like the ability to hold rent, to own a home. I was thinking about this in the amazing opportunity to get to tour someone's home. But if you've been evicted over and over again, or your parents threw out all your stuff, those opportunities are gone in an instant. So when you're asking somebody to recount their historical consciousness, I think that it only makes sense that they should be compensated for the work that it is to recreate those artifacts for you, or at least to be part of your recreation of them. Likewise, and we don't always just do this through in fact, it rarely turns into, here's a stack of cash, please talk to me, because that also puts a very strange pressure on someone to come up with the answers, so we don't usually do things like that. In terms of how, and I mentioned this in the beginning, how our oral history practice supports the community archiving aspect, an oral history is usually what precedes a collection being donated to our archives. Our archives only exist because people had things they could no longer hold on to but didn't want to see thrown away. So we digitize things for free because our background, Danny and I, is video art, and so, you know, codecs and things, second nature. But doing work like that for somebody in exchange for their time tends to not only do some sort of obvious transactional reciprocation, but it does it in such a way that you are listening to what they find important rather than being able to fill in the gaps of a story you're already building. As an example, there's a collection, and we have trouble with copyright because often people want you to digitize things that aren't yours to share. But there's an amazing trans porn star named Solka, who I can't really find her work anymore, but I have a oral history narrator and friend, because it's like the line blurred, who has collected her entire life's work, which includes working in porn before and after bottom surgery, which is super rare. And those tapes are where she gets a lot of her affectations and taglines. And so being able to put aside the, I think, kind of mainstream response of most libraries and archives and makerspaces to have the ugh, icky, feeling about digitizing porn or somebody's version of Top Gun, we recognize that that's actually how someone tells us what they need in order to discuss their historical consciousness. It's simply not outside of it. Besides that, I think it comes down to, you know, we pay for our storage ourselves. We're not an institutional project. We just don't have that kind of support. But it has become our method as well. So it's very, it's in small ways, but they're always very intentional. And I will never ask somebody to pay for that request. That's sort of been a founding principle, I think, of what we're up to. So does that help answer your question a bit? Okay. I have paid one person in cash, but to be fair, they were out of work, and it was what's the difference between that and adding money to someone's GoFundMe?
My question was for Jennifer and Benny. I was really interested in what you said about kind of taking and thinking about these artistic practices, which I find incredibly compelling, and using them as a way of changing the way that you do history, or sort of providing an opportunity to create a more sort of affectively holistic history, perhaps. Right now, I'm trying to write or work on my dissertation in cultural anthropology, and I'm sort of running up against the struggle of having a lot of different kinds of data that have some very sort of colorful and multifaceted representations of people's experiences and my own experiences, et cetera. And I'm sort of feeling this pressure to kind of flatten it and make it more suitable for like a dissertation, which will be a stack of pages that I turn into my committee. So I guess I'm wondering if you have advice for how to make that more like affectively holistic, how to sort of bring some of that artistic practice into this sort of academic flattening that I'm feeling forced to do.
Switch programs and do a practice-led PhD.
But it really is the case that the medium that we work with as historians, you know, forecloses all of these opportunities. I mean, an earlier iteration of my reflections on Benny's work was published in a journal, and you know, it was reliant on his soundscapes and on his audio guides. And you know, what academic journal can support, you know, examples that are audio, and they happen to have something, but it was clunky and it didn't totally work. So we are bound in a way, but I like to think that there are ways in which we can learn from what Benny's able to do, whether it's through bringing storytelling into our own way of writing, whether or not it's about emphasizing, you know, again, a multiplicity of possible outcomes, whether it's playing with your reader a little bit, you know, a little bit creatively with, you know, how you present the events. And of course it matters what the subject is that you're looking at. And it's one thing to write about queer desire in photography, which is one place where I'm able to be more creative. And it's another thing to write about, you know, police files. So that matters too.
I agree. But I also get the sense, where did you go? There you are. Yeah. Thanks for the question. I mean, I also get the sense that historians who are interested in affect and are writing about affect and are allowing affect to feel like feelings to lead the process of historiography creates more and more space for history to be written differently. I think about Fiona Anderson's writing. Fiona's here about cruising as a method of writing history and sort of tuning into the affective dimensions of cruising as part of writing history and art history, or erotohistoriography, Freeman's term. And I mean, I felt very lucky to be doing a practice-led PhD where I can keep following impulses that come from my sort of ever-evolving artistic process. And I don't think I even knew that I was contributing to history or doing history as I started, when I started, and as the project unfolded, I started to see the historiographic aspects of my work and curatorial and all sorts of other things that emerged. And I felt that there was just a lot of space, not only in a practice-led PhD, but in the kinds of art history and history writing that I was encountering that gave permission for confused, mismatched, random things to be valued, to lead, to be generative. So, yeah.
Any more questions? Anybody else? Maybe we can talk about what Jennifer mentioned during her talk or at the end, that we do not talk academically about certain subjects, what you mentioned earlier about things like cruising. Could you comment on that?
And of course, I can't speak to all the various ways in which people write the history of sexuality in other national contexts. But it's been my impression as a post-45 historian that, for very obvious reasons, the need to put on the map the struggles that have been fought that we've written our histories through sort of a social movement framework, which is much needed. But then what has fallen away, in a sense, is the everyday lives, the things that don't register as relevant, the things that are maybe not as savory, or the positions that are harder to actually advocate for in terms of gaining some form of a toehold in our communities. And so what's fallen away in this kind of unintentional respectability driven analysis is the stuff of love, lust, desire, and I think we have fallen, as historians, we've often fallen into that trap of making certain choices over others. And it's not to say that it's easy to write those kinds of histories. There are all sorts of pressures against writing that kind of history, whether it's in terms of securing funding, explaining the why does it matter to the powers that be. But I do think that there's a necessity for at least some of us to revisit those very core issues of the issues that you wonderfully showed in cyberspace are able to bubble up again to the surface about one's life experiences, one's earliest, initiation. And that's something that I think has really gone missing in the last little while. And maybe it's about the medium that allows for that that story to be told again.
Does anyone else, if you want to comment on that?
Sure. And the point you're making about where does this material belong, or not where it belongs, but how do you manage to get it through all of these hoops of what's publishable? One of my advisors, Elizabeth Kennedy, who wrote Boots of Leather, Slippers of Gold, about lesbian bars in Buffalo, New York, still feels like the book is missing what she called the ephemeral sex factor. Talking about these women as lesbians forecloses so much about what it takes to claim that identity, and also the way in which they are unfixed and unstructured, but still having to defend them as valid, social positions, the idea of butch femme relationships. And I do also want to add that I often run up against this problem, not so much as people saying you can't write that from the top down, but the things that people wish to tell and then also wish for you not to repeat comes up quite a bit. This is a way that I'm going to communicate with you, but this is not the story I'm allowing you to tell. And I mean, I kind of throw my hands up at that situation and just say that's your decision, and I'm not going to cross it. So just to point out also that it comes from both directions.
I think it's such an important point, and it really speaks to the various battles that are being waged. So it's significant. I totally take what I think would be a well-meaning critique of maybe the more rarefied nature of doing a project about, primarily men who, had positions in universities, and you know, benefited from their social position, right? And that is a very rarefied experience that is no longer even possible in this age of precarity. But the battle that's being waged over, you know, writing this story or doing this story is in getting the Social Science Humanities Research Council of Canada to fund it. It's about getting into galleries and museums, you know, the National Gallery. It's about putting, you know, the story of intergenerational queer sex, you know, out there as part of the narrative of queer kinship. So that's the battle that maybe in a way Benny's waging. That's a very different one than, say, what you both are doing. So, you know, those distinctions are super important and I think important to underscore.
I think also, I mean, I really take that point, and I think that my original, I set out to do research in many different spaces, and the three that I showed projects in were the ones that really kind of coalesced over the course of my research, and I mentioned some of the other people whose homes I visited, living and dead, and there are a number of people who I had correspondence with but didn't ever manage to gain access to their homes, and I can only say that it was a much more representative group of queers who I've dialogued with, and my ability to access is based on many number of variables, some of which I can guess at and some of which I can't. And in a way, I've struggled with the fact that I've ended up with these sort of fabulous homes of tenured white male professors, but also just try to accept that that's who let me in, who wanted to fold me into their lives, as opposed to those who blocked me in other ways. Exactly, yeah, you know, and I had to sort of accept that I wasn't necessarily welcome. I mean, I think some people had the capacity, but maybe not the interest to be part of my research, or for, so what if I'm interested and I've done all of this stuff? I don't belong to their community or I don't speak their language on one level or another. And so it's ended up being not a very representative group, but rather my relationships with three homes and collections. So I don't know if you wanted to comment.
To say that I took your question very differently at first when you said imagining these projects in a different space. I was thinking platform. So, like, I would like to hear your project on apartmenttherapy.com, personally. Apartmenttherapy.com? Yeah, it's sort of like the anti-realtor site where you talk about spaces, like very chic apartments. It's like, this is run by a small Southwestern artist with lots of peach hues. But I feel like that would work in the way that you can always sell that project differently. And in my case, I feel like trying to do community archiving, there are different demands on what sort of space you expect this material to exist in. If everything has to be digitized and everything has to go online, then you don't get to negotiate the internal dynamics of an archives with each individual donor, which for us is critical because that's the only basis of trust. So we don't digitize everything, and we don't share everything, and we also don't keep everything. We don't do contracts. If someone wants something back, we just give it back, even whether or not they have the capacity to preserve it ad infinitum. But likewise, I wanted to think about this in terms of more broadly, like the merit of a project I don't think should be automatically put to the stakes of and this is sort of the problem I have with that Ronald Greeley quote, a more complete, a more compassionate, a more conscious history, that it should be this like uber representative document. I don't think we're capable of that, and I think that's the direction that leads us to breaking down people into how well they are representative of different eras or things that we already understand. So when it comes to like how class plays out in each one, I think it's interesting, but it's not a matter of from best to worst aspect of like oppression Olympics. It's just these are the social worlds in which we're navigating, and next year that'll change.
Yes, you first and then you.
For the emphasis on the use in gay community, people Do you see any reflections of queer memories in cyberspace onto the representation of gay males in Taiwan media, such as like movies and TVs or online series?
Can you say again?
Okay, so your presentation on the emphasis on the youth in gay communities is something that's also happening in Japanese media as well. We are seeing disappearance of elderly gay males in Japanese movies and televisions. And I was wondering, like, how is Taiwanese media responding to the ageism of within gay communities, like you said? How is the media responding to reflecting queer memories, queer digital memories in cyberspace onto the representation of gay men in movies and TV series?
You mean how Taiwanese social media to represent gay ecology in Taiwan?
So you were talking about social media,
yes.
Or what do you call the chat-based database? But do you see any reflections of ageism, emphasis on youth in cyberspace onto representation of gay men in movies and TV or online?
I think a lot other media forms, they construct the young mainstream too, such as one month ago we have gay marriage in Taiwan, and you can see on the newspaper, on the social media, you only see the young gay or a young lesbian, such as a couple, Xiao Xuan. It's a couple gay, in the issue of gay marriage, they present all of the gay in Taiwan and show they want love, they healthy, they have sunshine beside them, and they are young, yes. So I think in the mainstream social media, gay elders always regards as objection in Taiwan. Yes.
Thank you.
There was a question. Okay. You want to ask another question? So that would be the last one.
So my question would be for Benny, but I think it's pretty much inspired by the second paper as well. So when I was looking at the first library, you were working on in Amsterdam, so my first reaction was this kind of like, wow, Beauty and the Beast kind of thing, I want this library. And I sure hope I'm not the only one that has this fetish for books, but at the same time I was thinking about the book as an object, and I was wondering if you could do the same kind of project with emails, with the libraries people have inside their computers. So I was like wondering, like, if you could have all those people in this steam bath in front of computer and basically going through the computer of your host, and what would it mean for like the same affect? Would it be the same kind of way you would think about it? Or you just hate things that are in computers?
I've never thought about that. I guess the project started when I was invited into one of these homes and was quite overwhelmed by the masses of physical objects that I was encountering, mostly books, but other things that you saw photographed, plants and objects and other aspects of the domestic world that these men had created. And I think that my correspondence, which is often by email with my hosts, with my subjects, figures into my research and has a expressive form in the artistic work, but I do stay quite focused on physical objects. And again, coming in with the audio guide, the museum audio guide, as the sort of kind of driving media form, it's very much about mediating encounters with artworks and artifacts, and I'm letting that aesthetic or that style lead. Of course, I could still do an audio guide to Tom's emails, you know. I mean, one of the things Tom Wall in Montreal has an amazing screensaver that he's created for his computer with like 10,000 pictures from bathhouses and across history. And I mean, it's an art piece in its own. And I could very much imagine making an audio guide that mediates this very digital form. For this project, I am sticking with physical three-dimensional objects, perhaps just based on my own impulses, but it's true that maybe I'm kind of leaving some important material out by not invading their computers.
Sure. Hi. This is a question for all of you, so any one of you can feel free to respond. These are all projects that take place somewhere outside of traditional academic space, and in each case, that's a lot of what makes the project so exciting. And I have a kind of very impure question, which is about navigating the doing of projects outside of that exist in this way outside of academic space and that are exciting because of that, when one is also trying to work within academic space, which is an increasingly difficult thing to do. And there are so many pressures to publish and to engage in traditional fora that to take time away from that to do this, even if this feels more interesting and more compelling, can seem impossible. And so I'm just wondering about how that has been to do, and maybe hoping to find some magic solutions from one of you brilliant people.
So that project being a part of the larger PQHP thing began before I had entered graduate school. I was a self-described just like artist at the time, and I sort of stumbled into public history. The short version of that story is that a friend of mine was opening a club venue and it had a lot of garbage in it, and if I helped her clean it out, I got to go to the shows for free for a year, and I kept all the garbage, and the garbage turned out to be very interesting. And that took a lot of different avenues. Actually, one of the stories I don't get to tell about this ball is that it was meant to also connect Connie with a lot of the younger ballroom generation in Pittsburgh, because it's young in the way that people don't survive, in the way that it's difficult to keep memory going through. But it's also just a different kind of scene, and it's influenced more at a national scale now. So anyway, they were not interested in coming. Nobody came. I tried to make an event with one of the leaders of a house in Pittsburgh, and they were just like, nah, sounds boring. That's their prerogative. Like, Connie is not their grandma. And so, that aside, I've been in graduate school for 4 years now, and I find that having a project that is bigger than my dissertation and outside of my graduate school affiliation and also across the country has been a huge blessing in disguise, because it helps me to keep, I think, the demands of graduate school from becoming a demand on the people that I work with. Like, they're a little bit more balanced, and sometimes it tears you apart, but then you just, disappear for a week. I don't know. Self-storage is a really big issue for us, but that's, having to, like, maintain physical collections is helpful. And I just try to make every, now that coursework is over, it's less relevant, but I try to make everything I do in grad school somehow useful, not just relevant to the work that the project is supposed to do. It's like there is no magic bullet. It's just always trying to figure out how to cheat the system a little bit.
This project, I want to tell myself, because I'm now maybe I'm a young generation of gay, and in Taiwan, I contrast my mainstream culture, and one day maybe 5 years old, five years past, I'll be an old gay. So I'm nervous that I will be old. So this paper, I will tell myself not to construct the hegemony in Taiwan society, and to I don't know how to say, because wait a minute. Yes, because last year I go with the elder gay bar in Taiwan. I see lots of gay elder in the bar. They are so lonely, disappointed, and they when I am as young gay, I'm working in a nightclub. They are so adore my body, adore my young. So because I'm rethinking why they are act like that, because in Taiwan society, we are focused on you must be healthy, and you must be not have any disease, or you must not have not a drug and such as drug or open relationship, and so. Let me think about what I'm talking about.
Can you
I mean, I'll just say briefly, sort of echoing a little bit about what Jen was saying, is that coming into this project as an artist, I didn't feel the kinds of limitations that are maybe placed on historians or scholars. But I'm jealous. I do feel that my project would not have been able to evolve had I not done it within a kind of academic framework and without the supervision that I received from my PhD advisors. And I think that the kinds of ideas and practices and thinking that I was introduced to through a PhD program really helped advance my aesthetics and my methods in a way that serves the research in the end. I think the fact that my subjects are scholars themselves and we're dealing with their collections of books and their love of theory and writing, I think framing it as a kind of research project and thinking of it as artistic research, which is something that I never did before I started a PhD, was extremely valuable and generative to the research. So, but still, as an artist, I feel a lot of freedom in terms of how I go about it. And, you know.
I'll just say two things very quickly. You know, of course, rank and status matters. I'm a full professor, and, you know, when I submit an application, there's this presumption that I know something, which, you know, whatever. You know, and that is significant. But I would say this, in terms of projects like these, in the days in which we live right now, I think it's even more important that we find ways and places to bring desire back into the equation. If we're talking about queer legibility in the face of far-right discourse, you know, we need to claim spaces in all of their manifestations. And so in that way, this work is keenly important alongside the other important work that's being done. But my pitch for bringing a little bit of desire back, I guess, so.
Okay, thank you all. Our time is up, always already. Thank you all for being here, for coming to this session, and thank you for your amazing presentations. Thank you very much.